www.ccc.org.
You can't drink the water in parts of Palm Beach County, and more than a half dozen shootings in a week leave scores of gun violence victims. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Some Palm Beach County residents have not been able to drink water from their taps safely for a week. Blue-green algae in the drinking water is to blame. When will the water be safe again, and why weren't residents warned earlier? Several shootings across Miami-Dade County have killed several people in recent days, wounded more, and will continue to impact the lives of those who have survived. What's in store for those families in the future? How do they deal with the ongoing trauma of gun violence? And then, more Cubans are braving the Florida Straits, hoping to make it to freedom. There's been a five-fold increase in Cuban migrants intercepted by the Coast Guard. It's all ahead on our program, made possible by Willie the Bee Man, bee removal specialist.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Former President Donald Trump will remain shut out of Facebook and Instagram until at least January 2023. The social media company suspended Trump's account following the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. Facebook's oversight board approved the suspension, citing concerns that Trump's posts were inciting violence, but also said that the company should set a time frame. The Vice President of Global Affairs, Nick Clegg, says the company is also changing its policy toward posts by political leaders and would be more transparent about the restrictions it imposes on users. U.S. employers added twice as many jobs last month as they did in April, though it missed economists' forecasts. But NPR Scott Horsley reports President Biden shared the new numbers as a sign of progress.
Employers added 559,000 jobs last month, and many businesses say they would have hired more workers if they had more applicants. Restaurants and amusement parks led the job gains, trying to keep pace with strong demand as pandemic fears recede and more Americans venture out. President Biden notes more than half of all adults in the U.S. have been vaccinated against the coronavirus. Here's the rest to get their shots.
This is progress, historic progress. Progress that's pulling our economy out of the worst crisis it's been in 100 years.
The unemployment rate dropped to 5.8% last month, partly because people found jobs, but also because some left the workforce altogether. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The Food and Drug Administration is about to decide whether to approve the first new Alzheimer's drug in nearly two decades. NPR's John Hamilton reports that scientists disagree about the drug's effectiveness.
The FDA has until Monday to make its decision on the drug aducanumab. The agency is weighing the results of two big studies that produced conflicting results about whether the drug slows down the disease. Harry Johns is CEO of the Alzheimer's Association. He says the group wants aducanumab on the market.
This is not a cure. This is an incremental benefit, potentially.
But scientists, including Dr. Jason Karlowish from the University of Pennsylvania, oppose approval.
The data just aren't there right now to say that this is the drug to open up the new era for the treatment of Alzheimer's.
Karlowish says approving the drug could give false hope to Alzheimer's patients and their families. John Hamilton, NPR News.
The European Union's blocking all Belarusian airlines from EU airspace and denying them landing or takeoff rights for EU airports. Terry Schultz reports EU airlines are also banned from using Belarus's airspace after a Ryanair flight to land in Minsk in order for officials to arrest a critical journalist.
Hundreds of flights per day will be affected by the ban on Belarusian planes using European airspace and vice versa. The Belarusian national airline normally flies to some 20 airports in Europe, including in Austria, France, Germany, and Italy. The EU is considering further measures against the regime in Minsk for its May 23rd actions that enabled the imprisonment of opposition blogger Roman Pratasevich and his partner.
Terry Schultz in Brussels. This is NPR News. Today is the 32nd anniversary of the Tiananmen Square crackdown in China. It is forbidden to commemorate the day in China. Hong Kong has held an annual vigil, but Hong Kong police have arrested two activists as China tightens its control over the region. We have more from NPR's Emily Fang.
One of those arrested is activist and lawyer Chow Hung Tong. She helps run the organization which holds each year's vigils. Through a lawyer, she said she would fast in remembrance since she could no longer light a candle while under arrest. Normally, tens of thousands of people in Hong Kong gather on June 4th to remember the untold numbers of democracy protesters killed in 1989 by Chinese soldiers in Beijing. Police have not authorized the vigil in Hong Kong in 2 years, citing the pandemic. Hong Kong residents are being encouraged by organizers to light a candle at home or take a walk on their own instead. Emily Fang, NPR News, Huzhou, China.
The finance ministers from seven of the world's wealthiest nations are reported to be close to an agreement on compelling multinational companies such as Facebook and Google to pay higher taxes. Reuters News Service cites the French finance minister's remarks to the BBC that the G7 group's nearing a historic deal, but disagreements reportedly remain, including on the minimum rate at which companies should be taxed. At last check on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 124 points since the open at 34,702. The NASDAQ has risen 189 points, or 1.3%. It's at 13,804. And the S&P has climbed 31 points. It's at 4224. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include DuckDuckGo, a privacy company committed to raising the standard of trust online. Used by tens of millions, they work to help people search privately and avoid trackers. DuckDuckGo, privacy simplified.
You can join United Way of Broward County's Commission on Behavioral Health and Drug Prevention for the 6th Annual Behavioral Health Conference on June 8th and 9th. The virtual conference will focus on mental health awareness, substance use, and suicide prevention, and more. You can also earn CEUs as you listen to featured speakers, including suicide prevention specialist Dr. Jerry Reed and addiction advocate Captain Lee Rosbach of Bravo TV's Below Deck. Registration at unitedwaybroward.org/BHC2021.
Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. It was a deadly and violent Memorial Day weekend across Miami-Dade County. Families, neighbors, police all hope to quiet the gun violence in the weeks ahead. Beginning today, 17 strike teams will fan out across the county. More police patrols will be on the streets, and law enforcement will pay closer attention to social media in hopes of heading off violence before it spills out in real life. Scores of people and their families are dealing with the trauma of the past week's shootings. Coming up on our program this week, what's in store for those families in the future? How do they deal with the ongoing trauma of gun violence? Join that conversation by calling now, 800-743-9576. Our phone number is, we're going to be talking about the ongoing trauma in communities and families from gun violence, 800-743-9576. You can also share your thoughts and experiences on Twitter. We're at WLRN. First up on this Friday, some people should not drink the water. This has been the warning for a week now in parts of Palm Beach County served by the West Palm Beach Water System. Cylindrospermopsin is the culprit. It's a toxin produced by blue-green algae, and the water isn't suitable for anyone younger than 6 years old, people with liver conditions, people who need dialysis, and the elderly. Boiling the water does not kill the bad stuff. In fact, it may actually make it worse. The toxin was found in the West Palm Beach water supply May 20th, but a public advisory wasn't issued until 8 days later. And as we're live on this Friday, the precautions remain in place. At a press conference on Thursday, West Palm Beach Mayor Keith James said the county had two consecutive days of tests showing what experts believe to be safe levels of the toxin.
Still comply with the advisory, but I am optimistic based upon the tests that our system is where it should be and getting even better.
So let's talk about this water. Has your water been affected by this toxin? Do you live in the area that's impacted by this advisory? How can this be fixed? And the bigger picture for all of us who have to live with water here in South Florida, after all, it's a way of life. Does this tell us anything about the state of South Florida freshwater systems? 800-743-9576, our phone number, 800-743-WLRN, at WLRN on Twitter. Kimberly Miller, reporter for the Palm Beach Post, back with us here on the Florida Roundup. Kimberly, great to have you. Thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
Thank you.
So let's talk about what areas are affected. Water systems in South Florida can be different depending upon where you live, of course. So what areas in Palm Beach are impacted by this advisory?
Okay, so first, they did just lift it about 11:30 this
Great.
Morning. They lifted it. They are saying to run hot water through your tap for about 5 to 10 minutes and change your filtration system in your ice cube, ice maker. But it is lifted, but it affected about 120,000 people in West Palm Beach, Palm Beach, and South Palm Beach. And like you said, it's been almost a week since we first learned of it, which was late last Friday at about 10 o'clock, they sent out the notice. So most people didn't find out until early in the morning or even in the afternoon.
Yeah. I appreciate you correcting me. So important, right? So what about 90 minutes or so ago on this Friday is when the advisory was lifted. And what are the precautions that people still need to take, though, after a week of knowing about this toxin in their water?
Right. So the health department recommends pretty much flushing out your system just by running hot water through the taps for 5 to 10 minutes. And they are suggesting changing any filtration systems you have, including in your refrigerator, ice maker.
Yeah. So anything that you're running fresh water that you drink in your home through, so a water filter in the sink, a water filter maybe in a pitcher of water that you put in the fridge, you'd want to replace all of those kind of filters.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Okay. So that's where we're at. So how did it get fixed?
Well, I think that's a good question. They did, they just put everything but the kitchen sink at it as soon as they found out that the second test was still positive, which was part of the problem, is that they got a result that wasn't necessarily unhealthy, and they got that back on May 5th. So then they tested again and got another result back May 19th that was at an unhealthy level, and they wanted to make sure they wanted to double check it. This is where they're getting a lot of flack, and they found out then on May 27th and alerted the public on the 28th. And so that's where the concern is coming in from residents and from some of the other towns that they didn't know. And as soon as they found out, they started flushing the system with free chlorine, adding some charcoal treatments. But I think the question that we need to get answered is, how did it happen in the first place? Because we know the conditions were there for this to grow, but they had been there in the past, and the plant, the water treatment plant, had been able to handle it previously. So I'm not sure, we haven't, really gotten that answered yet. Maybe what happened at the water treatment plant, or was it just overwhelmed by how many toxins were in the water?
Cylindrospermopsin is the toxin. Where does that come from? How is it produced?
It's a cyanobacteria. It's been around for billions of years. It likes certain things like still warm water. And the interesting thing about this is that we've been dealing with a microcystin for a long time, at least the past few years. And that is that blue, green, bubbling mats that you see on top of the water. I mean, you know, it's there. It smells. Yeah. It's gross looking. This stuff hides in the middle of the water column. It doesn't really turn any color. So there's really no outward, sign that it's there. So it's really only by this testing, which isn't required by the EPA. It's not regulated. The city of West Palm Beach does it because they realized several years ago that this was an emergent toxin that they needed to start testing for, just to be on the safe side. And so they test for this and for microcystin once a month. And they've said this is, the first time this has ever happened, although they had gotten positive tests in the Clear Lake, which is an above ground. We're only one of two above ground systems in the South Florida Water Management District 16 county area.
Right.
And so that's why we're vulnerable to having this kind of algae grow. Most people are on groundwater where you don't have this problem.
Yeah, right. They don't have the sunlight in the groundwater to help fuel the photosynthesis for the algae here. So you mentioned that the EPA does not require water treatment systems to test for this toxin. West Palm Beach does test for it regularly. The timeline of this coming up with the result on May 20th, but the advisory not being issued to the public, and the mayor of West Palm Beach saying he wasn't advised of this toxin at unhealthy levels until May 28th. Is part of the explanation there that these tests were done not in South Florida, but these samples were taken somewhere else to be tested?
Well, yeah. I mean, I just did do a story on that, is that it takes a long time to test for these things, unless, it's like an emergency situation, but they were sending the tests, their request to Michigan State. There are about 200 labs in Florida that do test for it, but it's still a matter of overnighting it. And then this little bacteria is a tough nut to crack. It, you have to freeze it, thaw it, freeze it, thaw it, freeze it, thaw it. Mm. And then to bust open the cell and get out the toxin, and then you can test for the toxin and get the parts per billion. Now, when this happened, the DEP, our sheriff's office, actually flew up samples to Tallahassee, and the DEP got turned around the results in 24 hours. So, but now the city is like, gosh, maybe we need to do this ourselves. Yeah. We need to start testing inside and see if we can set up our own lab.
I suppose an indication of how important this is when you have a law enforcement escort for vials yes. of fresh water right. on their way to Tallahassee in the Department of Environmental Protection. What role, if any, does the water in Lake Okeechobee play in this particular incidence of this toxin?
So it is a winding road yeah. to get to our drinking water. It's a very interesting system. So Lake Okeechobee feeds our Grassy Waters Preserve, which is our main drinking water, where we get our main drinking water. And when it starts to get low, we bring in water from Lake Okeechobee, because we also, Grassy Waters Preserve, feeds the Loxahatchee River, which is one of only two wild and scenic rivers in Florida. Mm-hmm. And so we're using our drinking water to feed the Loxahatchee, which we don't want to be harmed. So when our water gets low, though, this time we had to shut off the water from Lake Okeechobee because it was testing positive for microcystin. And so we weren't getting that feed. And so then Clear Lake, the Grassy Waters, feeds into Clear Lake, which is right before the water treatment plant. Grassy Waters and Clear Lake started to go down. The city asked to start using some emergency well fields they have. But Clear Lake had to get to a certain point, a certain level, before those permits were allowed to kick in. So when it finally got there, we started getting water from our eastern well fields. But by that time, this, cyanobacteria had just had a field day yeah. and was loving life and started growing.
Yeah. Hydrology may look simple for us right. lay people, but it is incredibly complex, and particularly here in South Florida. You did a wonderful job, Kimberly, kind of walking us through there. But I want to go back to Lake Okeechobee, which is at normal lake levels. It's not high. It's not low. We're at just the beginning of the wet season. So why was the water from Lake Okeechobee treated the way that it was, or shut off the way that it was?
Well, there was a bloom in the lake, mm-hmm. and it was about a month early, which was scientists were kind of confused about that. But we had about a large bloom on the lake, and that was getting into our canals. I mean, right now it's all over Palm Beach County's canals, and they're testing for it, and it's coming back with toxin levels that are near the harmful range. I think I saw one yesterday. It was 7 parts per billion, and 8 parts per billion is harmful. And this is in like people's backyard canals. So it was there, and it's always there, but yeah. when it's stagnant and we had, how many weeks of high pressure where it was just sunlight and no clouds. And it loves that, the microcystin. So it just grew, and we were getting the positive tests right at the area where we bring in the water to Grassy Waters Preserve. And that's when the city's like, we can't have that microcystin in there. And they shut down, that feed. But then meanwhile, the Cylindrospermopsin is, fat and happy in the
yeah.
Clear Lake.
Yeah. Yeah. Having spring break in South Florida. Right. So to speak. Yeah. So are they concerned about this? I mean, what is the kind of the odds or the science tell us about the potential return of this?
I know. So that's a good question. I mean, they're kind of framing it like this. There were very specific circumstances that happened this time to make it happen. But again, I think the question is, what was going on at the treatment plant that yeah. it's been able to handle this in the past and it didn't handle it this time? So I think that's, still questions that have to be answered. And as, the population grows in South Florida and the groundwater is spoken for, and we need to rely more on surface water possibly in the future, this is going to be a high priority that we're going to have to watch out for and start, states can regulate this, can do their own rules on it. So maybe it's something that Florida will have to look at.
Kimberly Miller, reporter at Palm Beach Post, with us talking about what had been a water advisory, a drinking water advisory for the customers served by the West Palm Beach water system. As Kimberly told us just about 11:30 a.m. here on this Friday, that advisory has been lifted, but households are advised to run their taps for a few minutes and to replace any water filters that they use for freshwater drinking water. Kimberly, thanks for sharing your reporting with us. Much appreciated.
Great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, have a great weekend. Kimberly Miller, again, reporter for the Palm Beach Post. Stick with us here on the South Florida Roundup. Lots to talk about after a very violent and deadly Memorial Day holiday weekend. We'll talk about the ongoing trauma in families and communities from gun violence. That's next.
The Nest, the Echo, the HomePod, whatever you call it, your smart speaker is a marvel of technology that keeps you connected. Connect to us anytime simply by asking your device to play WLRN. Try it now and enjoy 24 hours of news or classical music. WLRN would like to thank the South Florida business community for their support of the WLRN Corporate Circle. With a Corporate Circle membership, you are not only supporting your local public radio station, but your business will be recognized as a leader in our community who is committed to promoting truth, facts, information, and engagement. Learn more about how your business can become a member at wlrn.org/corporatecircle. We're funded by WLRN members and by Florida State University. FSU license plates support scholarships for students who enrich and contribute to the state and nation. More information on FSU plates is available at fsu.edu/mytag.
Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening and supporting public media. Shootings in Miami-Dade County over Memorial Day weekend have left families of victims reeling and still seeking answers.
So we are begging you to share this video, share any information, who you saw at the party. We need everyone that was at the party to be brought in for questions. So we ask that you all, please, please, I don't care about snitches get stitches. No snitching, no conviction. So we need y'all to open up your mouth and say something.
That's the aunt of 26-year-old Desmond Owens on Thursday this week. Owens is one of three people killed in a mass shooting at the El Mula Banquet Hall in northwest Miami-Dade over the holiday weekend. 21 people survived. It was just one of several shootings over the Memorial Day weekend from Wynwood to the Design District, Miami Beach. Police are responding with what they call Operation Summer Heat. This is Miami-Dade Mayor Daniela Levine Cava on Thursday.
With our Miami-Dade County Police Department working alongside our federal, state, and our municipal law enforcement agencies, we will use every available resource to swiftly bring these criminals to justice.
Beginning today, Friday, the policing strategy includes more patrols on the streets of Miami-Dade County, more monitoring of social media, where police say some of the violence begins. Beyond the law enforcement response, though, are the ripples of trauma in the communities throughout South Florida experiencing this violence. Romania Dukes founded Mothers Fighting for Justice to help cope with the death of her 18-year-old son, DeMichael Dukes. He was shot by a stray bullet in 2014. She spoke at the press conference Thursday when the Miami-Dade County officials announced Operation Summer Heat.
When I go home, I'm screaming and hollering because I can't get that gunshot out my head. Mm-hmm. I can't get that vision from my son trying to catch his breath. And in front of hundreds of people that was in the complex that didn't say they see nothing. Everybody seen something. We all know who our killers are. And it's up to our community to stand up. Our community needs to stand up and stand up now.
Well, what are the mental health impacts in the community of this trauma? How can people affected by gun violence heal? Where can they find support in the days, weeks, months, and years after gun violence? We want to hear from you. Share your experiences with us. Do you have students who are survivors of gun violence? Friends, family members, coworkers, colleagues? Have you been affected by gun violence? Seen it in your community? What steps are being taken in your neighborhood to address and prevent gun violence? 800-743-WLRN, our telephone number to join us for this live conversation on this Friday. 800-743-9576. You can also share your thoughts with us on Twitter, at WLRN is our handle. Denise Brown joins us. She is the CEO and founder of RJT Foundation, a nonprofit that provides support for families who've lost their children to violence. Denise, welcome to the program. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
You are one of those that have been personally affected by gun violence. Your son, Roman Bradley, was killed by a drive-by shooting in front of a friend's home in 2012. He was just 20 years old. I'm sorry for your loss. It still must be fresh today as it was in 2012. What can you tell us about your son?
Absolutely, it is still fresh. Actually, it wasn't just my son, but it was his best friend. Mm. He and his best friend both were murdered. I can tell you that he was a lively person, always happy. He was the joy of the family. And when they took my son away from me, it's like everything in the house was impacted, even on down to his favorite pet dog. Mm. We never heard her cry as much as she did. She cried all day as if she knew something had happened to him. So this violence is devastating. It impacts not only the family, but the neighbors and anybody that's associated with the victim. My son was expecting his first child. Also, his friend was an expecting father. Neither one of them was able to see their children being born. My son, his daughter was born 2 months after he was murdered. And that still, it just resonates with me, the fact that he never got an opportunity to hold her. He wasn't able to take her first day of school. And he was so excited about the birth of his child that he was fixing up his room and talking about it just the day before he was murdered. So it's really devastating.
Yeah. Yeah. Unspeakable devastation. And I appreciate you lending your voice to us here on WLRN to hear it, Denise. Given the violence that this community experienced over the Memorial Day weekend and this mass shooting we saw in unincorporated Miami-Dade County at this banquet hall, among other shootings, what would you like to say to the families, first of those who did not survive this violence?
Well, I would like to extend my sincere condolences to the family. There's really no words at this time. When you're impacted by this devastation, you really look at everybody as if they're a suspect, because nobody talks. Nobody comes forward to say that they've seen anything. So you're just hurt mm-hmm. all the way around. And there really is no words. But I do want to say, this will take some time. Your life will never be the same. You can turn your pain into a purpose. Just doing what you're doing by asking the community to give you time to heal, to give your family privacy, and also to come forward if you know anything or you've seen anything. So my heart goes out to those who have been impacted by this violence, and it has to end. We all have a stake in this, and we all have to get involved. And for a long time, this violence has been in our community, and for a long time, people have, they haven't been doing as much as they could. They haven't been using their platforms as much as they could. Mm. Extending their resources. So it takes a lot, and it's going to take everybody to really get involved.
Yeah, part of the conversation we want to have here on WLRN is about resources and what the availability of resources for the community are in moments like these, and how that's changed, Denise, since your awful experience in 2012. Denise Brown is the CEO and founder of RJT Foundation, a nonprofit that provides support for families who've lost their children to violence. We're talking about this past weekend's violence, gun violence in South Florida, the response by law enforcement, but perhaps most importantly, how a community responds and the trauma that is left in a community with gun violence and survivors and the fatalities. 800-743-WLRN to join our conversation. 800-743-9576. Dr. Natasha Palopoulos is with us now, licensed clinical psychologist for the Holtz Family, Holtz Children's Hospital at the University of Miami Jackson Memorial Medical Center. She often consults on gun violence survivor cases. Dr. Walker, to the program, thanks for sharing your expertise with us.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. And thank you so much, Denise, for also sharing your perspective. I also want to extend my sincerest condolences to all the families in Miami and across the U.S. that are being so afflicted by this horrible epidemic of gun violence. My heart really goes out to all of those families going through this difficult time.
Dr. Palopoulos, there are more than two dozen families who are survivors of gun violence over just the past week in Miami-Dade County alone. And those are just the cases of the gun violence that have made the news. What are they experiencing, those survivors?
I mean, they're experiencing a whole lot. When we're consulted initially in the hospital for survivors of gun violence and gunshot wounds, we're being asked to assess for things like acute stress disorder, which is really kind of the precursor, the first month after an incident that's traumatic that starts to look like PTSD symptoms. So we're talking about symptoms that are affecting people across the board from an emotional, behavior, cognitive, physical, and interpersonal level.
And so what are some of the techniques, the early techniques that those families should be familiar with?
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing I would say is just knowing that at least here at Jackson, which we do have Rider Trauma, we have Holtz Children's in Jackson, Maine, is that we do have both adult and pediatric psychology consult services. So having families reach out for support, the earlier we can intervene and start to talk about what's going on emotionally and start to monitor symptoms of trauma, then we can often see what a prognosis may look like, and we can see what type of post-discharge care may be needed for a family and for a survivor.
Denise, how do you think the community support has changed since the murder of your son in 2012?
Well, I'm happy to know that they offer that service at the trauma center because when my son was murdered, there was nobody there to offer any services to me. And that was one of the things that prompted me to start the RJT Foundation, is because I tried to get help for my son, who actually lost two brothers within the same time period by guns. And I wanted to get him services, and he was denied services because of insurance reasons and this, that, or the other. And I think at this time, no child should be denied services, especially when it comes to healing, therapy, and counseling and things of that nature. You shouldn't have to worry about having the right insurance and if the insurance would cover it or not. And I find that that's what happens in the urban communities. It's like business as usual. When something like this happens, who is there? Who goes out to the schools to notify the teachers to let them know, hey, this child needs to have some additional help or maybe additional time during testing because he or she has just gone through a traumatic experience. Within the urban community, it's like business as usual. And that's sad because there's no real healing. There's no therapy. Like now, how many mobile units was launched when this incident occurred, all of this violence? How many mobile units that had therapists and counselors available to see these people?
Dr. Palopoulos, how do you answer, Denise, particularly when it comes to just the economic question of treatment, the cost of the treatment, the accessibility of the treatment, both in terms of the economic accessibility as well as the actual accessibility, having these resources in neighborhoods nearby and within the community and other institutions that are touched by this gun violence because people are involved?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Denise, I couldn't agree with you more. We have, I think, just a problem across the U.S. about providing psychological resources to children, to families, and to adults that are going through something like this. I know one place that we often try to look at is community mental health centers. So here at Jackson, we have Jackson Behavioral Health Hospital, and we do have psychologists and psychiatrists here that, you know, they do try to see patients on the outpatient side, but that can really fill up quickly. So it starts to become a problem with insurance. I know here at Jackson, we really try to see people who are covered by Medicaid, who may be uninsured. So I really think there needs to be a stronger push for mental health in our communities. I know that in Miami, we also, for children, have the Children's Bereavement Center, which is an excellent resource for survivors and also the families of survivors, or unfortunately those who have passed, and that can provide grief counseling for families. There's also some books, which those are more guiding for parents, that can start opening conversations with children about gun violence in our communities. Two of those books are Something Happened in Our Park, Standing Together After Gun Violence, and another children's book I often recommend, which is A Terrible Thing Happened. And, you know, if we're having trouble finding direct outpatient resources, we can at least try to provide handouts and information and psychoeducation to families prior to discharge, so they can feel somewhat equipped with assessing their children and then seeing if they can reach out for more help in the community.
It strikes me remarkably that you may have to resort, doctor, to handing out children's books as a support tool.
Well, so I would say that these are tools that open up conversations. You know, we're seeing children on the acute side, and with trauma can be extremely complex and unique. So some people may not exhibit symptoms till later on. So the books are just more resources for families to open up these conversations. But yes, I agree with you, and I agree with Denise, is that we do need more community mental health. We do need more funding. We need more providers, because gun violence is really affecting impoverished neighborhoods, and neighborhoods where this has very sadly become something that's common. And that is devastating to hear when I'm speaking with children in the hospital.
Dr. Natasha Polopoulos is with us, the licensed clinical psychologist at Holtz Children's Hospital, University of Miami, Jackson Memorial. Denise Brown still with us, CEO and founder of RJT Foundation, nonprofit providing support for families who've lost their children to violence. 800-743-WLRN to join our conversation about gun violence in communities, the trauma that lasts far beyond the headlines of gun violence, the like that the community experienced, for instance, over the long Memorial Day weekend. 800-743-WLRN. Albo is with us in Miami. Albo, you've been very patient. Thank you. Go ahead. Albo, you with us?
I'm here.
Okay, you're live on the radio. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, there are many things to be said, and I enjoyed listening to the commentary of the former speaker who was talking about people that are victims of gun violence. But I'd like to say several things connected. It's all connected. Much or most of this gun violence is black people shooting other black people, which is a sad commentary. The cost to our society, if you start looking at what is the cost of putting a person into the hospital for a week or two or three, surgery and emergency rooms that have been shot, is a phenomenal cost. Yet we got little children in elementary school that are going to school starving and hungry. Maybe we could use those millions of dollars instead to feed those children, but we got to spend it for people that have been shot. And much of this violence, much, not all, but much of it centers around the drug trade, which is now fueled and boosted by tens of thousands of illegal aliens coming into our southern border from other countries, spreading across the U.S., and it's all connected.
Well, Albo, I'm not sure that final point. I've seen much evidence to the immigration exodus that we've seen of people fleeing their own areas of violence, particularly in Central America, contributing to what you have claimed there. But the kind of community violence, Denise Brown, would you like to respond to Albo?
Well, I don't totally agree with everything that he said, because there's mass shootings all over the United States. not just in urban communities. Yeah. Whereas the mass shootings that affect other communities, they have maybe 20, 30 people that are murdered. And we have that amount that's happening on a daily basis, maybe weekly. So it doesn't matter whether it's, you know, a black on black, or it's somebody that's shooting people in a mass shooter. The resources is what's important, and what we definitely need in order for things to turn around and to get better. You have to have healing. You have to have some type of support. You can't say we need to take away that and use it for other resources. Then that means that you just don't want to do anything about the violent problem. And this is a serious problem, and it's not going to get better. It's going to get worse if you don't do anything about it.
Fran in Davie wants to address the importance of mental health in these incidents. Fran, thanks for calling in. You're on the radio.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm very passionate about this issue. I've been in education over 40 years. My daughter is a mental health counselor, and this is such a pernicious problem. I don't understand why we don't have mental health services readily available in Publix and Walmart and Target, so that people who are thinking of using a gun on themselves or others have resources at their fingertips, and families who are victims of gun violence can't walk into a Publix, do their shopping, and go in and see a mental health counselor. It's just outrageous that in this day and age, our mental health system is so poorly resourced. Hmm.
Fran, I appreciate you planting that idea. An interesting one there, a pub sub and maybe a mental health checkup for anybody along those lines. Doctor, what do you make of the accessibility of mental health, particularly when it comes to gun violence and in this community, right? I mean, South Florida, and after the Parkland tragedy, has had a significant conversation around community support, mental health of particularly teenagers, young adults, and others after experiencing the kind of mass violence that we saw perpetrated in Parkland and the kind of violence that we saw over the Memorial Day weekend.
Yeah, and thank you, Fran, and for sharing your thoughts. I think there's a little bit of logistics that go into that. I mean, what a wonderful idea to have mental health accessible at our fingertips. That would be the ideal. You know, there's a lot more that goes on in the background of that. And yes, some does have to do with insurance. Some does have to do with billing. It's also confidentiality and privacy. So if there was something like that, that was more in a community mental health, I'm all for that. I'm all for more community mental health. I think that for children, sometimes resources are a little bit more available than they are for adults. Mm-hmm. But again, everyone is being affected by this violence. So you know, really just making a push.
Pardon the interruption, doctor, but that's
mental health.
That's an important point, right? Particularly as the violence that we saw over the Memorial Day weekend, young adults and you know, folks in their 30s. Were directly affected by this, not those who may have access to some mental health structures that may be embedded in the school system, for instance.
Right. And the hope is that there are counselors, social workers, sometimes even school psychologists at different schools within Miami-Dade, and the hope is that they can be meeting with students. I know that that also can become burdensome, but that would also be ideal, is to have someone at school or at their university that they can go and speak with.
Yeah. Denise Brown, let me ask you, as one who has lost a child to gun violence, who was murdered by a gun, when you hear of countywide initiatives like what we heard on Thursday from Miami-Dade County officials and police, about how they want to target violence through stepped up patrols and stepped up monitoring of social media, does it give you hope that it will prevent families from having to experience what you've had to endure for the better part of a decade?
Not much, because I think it takes more than that. It's going to take a lot. It's not just stepping up in security measures. It's a whole list of things that need to happen. I do agree that you know, part of funding should go to security cameras and maybe investigations and helping, you know, with police cameras. But more so, I believe that we need to put more focus on healing people that are impacted. So it would be nice to have trauma recovery centers, mobile units, healing therapy, counseling, more resources into witness protection so that people who witness this type of violent activity, they will feel more comfortable and safe to come forward and testify. We need housing. Some people who are impacted may live in areas where they may not want to go back to because this is another trauma. They have to go back to the same area and relive the same crime. And then if there's more violent activity, see, they never heal. We need programs, more education for crime victims, crime survivors, children that live in high crime areas. So it's a lot. It's going to take a lot. It's going to take resources. And we can't just say we're going to put all of those resources into police or into investigations. It has to be across the board.
Dr. Palopoulos, for those that have found themselves now with a direct experience of gun violence because of what this community has experienced over the past 7 days alone, what do they have in store for them in the months and years ahead?
Yeah, so I mean, one thing I really, Denise, what a wonderful, you know, perspective and insight. I want to touch on Denise's point to go into my response, which is that this is something that we are seeing frequently, is that when there is gun violence, it's oftentimes in the neighborhood or in the community. And going back to the place that's so close to home where this violence occurred can be very re-triggering for a lot of children, adolescents, and I'm sure adults. So that's a huge factor. In an ideal world, we would be able to come to this from a preventative standpoint. But unfortunately, we're living in a time that, you know, as Denise mentioned, this is going to take a long time and a lot of resources for us to see improvement. So we really have to bulk up our intervention and prevention. And the intervention part is where we can step in with community mental health and mobile crisis units. So just from a psychological standpoint, to answer your question about individuals who are survivors or people who are being indirectly impacted by this in the community, you know, we can start to see symptoms of trauma. And I know most people are familiar with PTSD, which stands, you know, for post-traumatic stress disorder. So I will say that not all people will develop PTSD. There will be some people that do and some people that don't. Trauma is so unique to everyone. But oftentimes when we're thinking of trauma symptoms, we're seeing things like being hypervigilant, being more on edge, more responsive to different stimulation, kind of feeling like you're revved up all the time. We can also see a lot of reliving experiences such as flashbacks, nightmares, intrusive thoughts. We can also see symptoms that really look like depression and anxiety and a lot of avoidance about places or people that are a trigger for a trauma. So those are things to definitely be on the lookout if you're seeing a family member or someone close to you who's experienced a traumatic event, if they start to endorse symptoms or start to show symptoms like that.
Dr. Natasha Palopoulos, a licensed clinical psychologist for the Holt Children's Hospital at the University of Miami Jackson Memorial. Doctor, thanks for sharing your expertise with us.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me on. I enjoyed this conversation. I think it's critical that we talk about these things.
Indeed it is. Denise Brown, CEO and founder of RJT Foundation, a nonprofit providing support for families who've lost their children to violence. Denise lost her son to gun violence in 2012. Denise, thank you for sharing your personal experience with us as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we should note here on this Friday, as we're live, this Friday, today, is Gun Violence Awareness Day. Still to come on our program here on the South Florida Roundup, Cuban and Haitian migrants continue seeking freedom in Florida. We'll talk about that next.
If your child is a young artist dreaming of being accepted into a prestigious arts magnet school or university, this summer ICA Miami invites them to participate in a free online portfolio prep program for aspiring artists in middle and high schools. For 2 weeks, students will connect with museum educators, mentors, and working artists in courses designed to develop their portfolios and gain a competitive edge in the art school application process. You can enroll online at icamiami.org.
The COVID-19 pandemic hit South Florida's economy hard.
I can tell you we're down 40%.
The future doesn't seem very bright for the independent restaurant.
But it has been recovering.
The future looks much, much better.
This is pretty much like pre-COVID. And actually, this is better than pre-COVID.
Here are the stories shaping South Florida's economy on the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. The program returns on Mondays in September, made possible by Kaufman Rawson. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. One group made it to Bilbag State Park on Key Biscayne on Monday. 11 people came ashore in Pompano Beach the same day. These were separate boats. They carried migrants from Cuba, Haiti, Jamaica, and Trinidad. They survived the trip across the ocean to Florida. Last week, a boat carrying 20 people across the Florida Straits toward the Keys sank. 10 people were lost at sea. 2 others died. 8 people were rescued by the U.S. Coast Guard. These are just the latest attempts of people trying to make it to Florida's shore. There's been a 5-fold increase in the number of Cuban migrants caught by the U.S. Coast Guard and Customs this fiscal year compared to a year ago. 800-743-WLRN to discuss this increase we're seeing in migrants and why. 800-743-9576 and what they're greeted with if they make it to Florida. WLRN America's editor Tim Padgett is with us. Timothy, why this increase?
Well, it has mostly to do with the conditions in these countries, Cuba, Haiti in particular. Cuba and Haiti, their economies are just ravaged right now by the pandemic and other factors. In Cuba, last year, we saw the economy contract by 11% as the pandemic, just as I said, ravaged its main industry, tourism, which was down by about 70%, if not more. And that has just left a lot of Cubans feeling economically desperate. And then when you compound that desperation with the political repression that they're feeling, which often happens when the economy is bad, because that's when the regime feels it needs to put more control socially on things, then you see a lot of people take to the rafts. Mm. And the same thing's happening in Haiti. Almost half the population there right now is going hungry, according to the UN. And you're seeing a terrible violent crime situation, a terrible wave of ransom kidnapping that's overtaken the country. And you also have a lot of political repression there these days under authoritarian President Jovenel Moise. So in both of those countries, you're seeing this really distressing cocktail of factors that are driving these migrants again across the Caribbean to South Florida.
For those that do make it onshore, what do they face in terms of U.S. immigration enforcement and policies?
Well, for Cubans, it's a much different situation than it was, say, you know, a few years ago. There is no such thing as, you know, the wet foot, dry foot regulation anymore that would allow Cubans to, automatically come in on a path to residency here if they make it to shore. With that kind of immigration welcome not available to mm-hmm. them anymore, it really puts them in a immigration limbo that Cubans just have not been accustomed to. For Haitians, there is a misconception amongst a lot of Haitians who are coming here now that because President Biden just extended TPS, or mm-hmm. temporary protected status, that he extended that for another 18 months to Haitians residing here, they feel that they will be able to avail of themselves of that possibility if they arrive here as well. But that's a misconception, as I said, because according to the TPS regulations, that is only extended to people, Haitians, who have been residing here before May 21st. So as soon as those Haitians arrive here thinking that they themselves might get TPS, they're going to be sorely disappointed.
And so do these migrants then face deportation, essentially?
They may. A lot of them are coming with asylum petitions. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them may have valid asylum petitions regarding, as I mentioned before, the political repression that is just keeps getting worse in Haiti right now. The UN, for example, recently blamed the government for a number of police massacres that have happened in the country. And of course, in Cuba, the political repression situation is no better. Yeah. And so they may have valid asylum applications to make, just as, for example, Venezuelan migrants who are coming here in droves these days have.
The migrants, the people, the policies that have been driving the just disastrous conditions politically, civilly, and economically in these countries. What about the politics here, though, Tim, and particularly the Biden administration's approaches to Haiti and Cuba? Very different, of course, but the uptick in migrant interceptions that the Coast Guard is reporting, is that putting pressure on the administration to make any changes to how it's approaching Haiti or Cuba?
Not quite yet, but I think it will, particularly with regards to Haiti. Right now, there's sort of a, as critics are calling it, sort of a hands-off approach to President Jovenel Moise and his authoritarian governance there. The Biden administration is hoping that if it can just wait things out until September, when Moise has said he will allow new presidential and parliamentary elections to be held, then maybe the situation will improve. Again, critics think that's a rather simplistic approach. There's a tendency in U.S. foreign policy to think that elections will solve every problem, and that may not be the case in Haiti. And with regards to Cuba, so far, again, the Biden administration is taking a wait-and-see approach. It's sort of keeping President Trump's rather draconian sanctions policy against Cuba in place at the moment and waiting to see what it really wants to do with regards to Cuba. But again, with these raptors coming in increasing numbers, they may have to act more quickly and find ways to help improve that economic situation in Cuba without helping the regime. Which, as you know, would be very unpopular.
Yeah. We have just about a minute left or so, Tim, but the role of the congressional delegation here in South Florida, what role is that playing? Is it changed with the Biden administration? It became more conservative, this delegation of South Florida congresspeople.
Exactly. And that's why I think you've got a lot of pressure from that delegation here on the Biden administration not to go easy on the Cuban regime. And that, as I mentioned, could exacerbate the economic situation and the desperation situation there. With regards to Haiti, a lot of the Democratic congressional delegation here in South Florida has really not been pressuring President Biden to change his approach to Haiti because they want to show support for him. So it's a very, very difficult situation.
Yeah. WLRN's America's editor Tim Padgett sorting through the politics, policies, and most importantly, the people affected here with the migrants. Tim, thanks for sharing your reporting.
Thank you, Tom.
That'll do it for the South Florida Roundup this week. It is produced by Andrea Perdomo. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre, with help from Raquel Cornell Uribe. Lance Dixon is our digital editor. News director is Terrence Shepard. Lisa Zuckerman is our editorial director. The director of radio operations and the program's technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, listening, and supporting public radio. You can find us on social media, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And don't forget about the website at WLRN.org. And, of course, podcasts of each and every South Florida Roundup by searching South Florida Roundup on your favorite podcast app. Don't miss a week. Our program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.
This is South Florida's only NPR news source, 91.3 WLRN and HD1, Miami-Fort Lauderdale, 91.5 WKWM and HD1, Marathon, Key West, 90.7 WFLV, HD4, West Palm Beach, and 101.9 NPR for the Palm Beaches.
Veritage Miami celebrates its 25th year with their interactive dinner. Celebrity chef Adrian Calvo will guide guests on June 18th as they prepare a gourmet dinner at their table, at the live event, or at home. You can join local foodies and philanthropists to benefit United Way of Miami-Dade and support programs that improve the education, financial stability, and health of the community. Sponsors and guests will have the choice to participate virtually via live stream or in person. Tickets and details at veritagemiami.com.
If you are listening to this message, so are your prospective customers. If your business would benefit from reaching the WLRN audience, we invite you to become a founding member of the WLRN Corporate Circle. With a Corporate Circle membership, you are not only supporting your local public radio station, but your business will be recognized as a leader in our community who is committed to promoting truth, facts, information, and engagement. Learn more about how your business can become a member at wlrn.org/corporatecircle.
Educational reporting on WLRN is brought to you in part by Bean Automotive Group, whose Kendall Toyota and West Kendall Toyota are committed to supporting educators in South Florida. You can buy or sell a car and get auto service, all at Kendall. Information at 305 Kendall.